The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening, and welcome back to our six-week Introduction to Mindfulness Meditation class. And this is the third week, so we're building a little bit on what's happened the weeks before. And people are still coming in, so it might be nice to take a few minutes at the beginning, again, to take some questions or reports how the meditation's going, those of you practicing at home, or anything you want to bring up as we're kind of start a little bit more informally. So either, yes, please. Is there a mic we could have passed? Thank you.
So there are meditation practices where you are trying to, or we think we're supposed to make our minds go blank. Is that a thing we should be trying to do, or that's not what we're...
What would it look like if it was blank? What would that be like?
You have any Mine idea? Certainly isn't, so I have no idea.
You have no idea. There are times when the thinking mind gets quiet, and sometimes it seems to stop entirely. And it can usually, when that happens, it feels very good and relaxing, and people find it very meaningful to have that happen. If it happens, then we are mindful of that. The idea in mindfulness meditation is not to try to make something happen, particularly, but to be mindful of what is happening. And so next week we'll talk about mindfulness of thinking. And so, and thinking is not meant to be something you have to get rid of, but rather something that you become mindful enough of that you have some freedom from it, some relief from being knotted up in it. So it's best not to have set up as a goal to have the mind go blank. Sometimes people do that, it ends up being more like repression. Or going numb. So straight, Martha, straight back in the back.
Okay. When we were doing the exercises that you were showing us last week while we were here, it was easier for me, and I thought, oh, this is cool, I can do this, I'm really good at it. And I thought, when I get home, it's going to be that much better. But in the mornings when I do it, or even the first morning, was at first it was really good, and it got bad really fast. And I know I'm being all judgmental, but right. It was like scary bad, like emotions on top of judgments on top of just chasing each other around, like it was like this wild party that was going on in my head. And I thought... I got so distracted that I thought my impulse was I just wanted to get up and run away. It was so loud in my head.
Yes.
And I thought, so the question is, I guess, since they call it practicing meditation, it's going to get better, isn't it? Hopefully.
Yes. It generally, for almost everyone who does meditation on a regular basis, the meditation brings a lot of improvements to their life and to meditation. Exactly how it unfolds varies from person to person. There are some people from whom meditation deepens or progresses in a nice way, and they really see in the meditation some change. There are other people who their meditation itself doesn't seem to ever change. They're always thinking somehow. But they've noticed that when they meditate, it really makes a big difference in the rest of their life. And they become really dependent on meditating every day because of the stability it provides, even though they don't see in the moment of meditation much meditative states. So different people have different ways in which it unfolds because of, who knows, all the reasons. We're all different in some ways. The other thing is that people who are sometimes quite concerned about making progress and getting better, they'll have a particular idea what that's supposed to look like. And usually they have the idea it's supposed to be linear from worse to better. And in the inner psychological life doesn't follow a linear, so obvious, overt, linear model of from worse to better. It goes in spirals and loops and everything. And so it's kind of like this. that say imagine that there's all these different floors in your psyche, in your mind. And so you're taking, you're moving down the stairs, the different floors, and you come, so you've never been in this building before, and so you go into the first floor, the top floor or something, and it's, they keep that floor really clean. And you say, wow, this is like the best place, like a palace. This is wonderful. And then, but the idea is to go down and see the whole building. So then you go down to the next floor. And they haven't cleaned that for 50 years. And it's a mess. And so you encounter the mess, but you're in the process of going deeper. But it looks like things have gotten worse. So, but actually you need to, it hasn't gotten worse in the sense of the path you're taking. You're definitely going on the path that'll take you down to the bottom of the building, if you like that analogy. But then you have to deal with the floor that's all a mess. And so many of us have floors or rooms or something in our psyche that haven't been taken care of for a long time. And so sometimes in meditation, sooner or later, the unattended rooms, the unresolved issues, will show themselves. Some people it happens right away, and some people it might take years before it happens. So with you, I think that is definitely something that can happen. It's not unusual for new people to have this happen. So you have a number of choices. When you said it got scary, if you really feel like you're panicking or really kind of being pulled down in a way that's not useful, you can just end the meditation. Just open your eyes and look around and realize you're in a good place and safe, and then start again, or just end it. Another approach would be if you have the right attitude, the right understanding, enough confidence for this, what we would do, what we suggest, with the right confidence, is say, this is really difficult. This is crazy. This is like and I think what's happened is that I've just some strong inner tendency, strong pattern that I have, has just been released. And in this practice of mindfulness, the task is to really see the full catastrophe. And now I get to see it. This is not comfortable. It's not nice. This is, but this is what my mind is producing. So let me sit back and go along for the ride. Let me go back and see and really get to know what this full storm is like. But that confidence to do that comes with this little extra thing, which is very nice, is curiosity or interest. And if you have enough curiosity and interest, then you're not completely locked into it or lost. If there's no curiosity, no interest to look and step back and be with it, then there's a danger you might spiral out if you go in. Then it better just end the meditation. Does that make some sense? So, Martha here.
So the curiosity and interest for me, I've been exploring that, but I realize it just creates more dialogue.
Yes.
And so I struggle back and forth.
So for you, don't be curious. So my teacher in Burma, in Asia, he said curiosity is a kind of greed. So stop it. Just be present. Just look without curiosity. Okay. And then when you do the investigation to look, don't... she should be curious, but you shouldn't, right? So... But definitely it's to look more carefully. But as you look and notice what's going on, you'll notice what you just did is that you start spinning out an inner dialogue more, right? You're more agitated. That's an indication that it's not helpful to investigate that way. And so then you got to course correct and quiet down, relax, don't think so much. Let the investigation be non-discursive. And so an image that works for me, I don't know if it works for anybody else, maybe it's claustrophobic for some people, but the image of finding your way in a dark cave. So you can't think, because you can't see, but you feel your way in the cave with your hands. And so the inner life, as you sit with you, being with your breath, or what's going on, it's more like you're sensing it and feeling it than you are thinking about it. And you're certainly not analyzing it and trying to figure out where it comes from, how to, And so the idea is to let that thinking mind become quiet. So I would encourage you to try that. I saw one more. Let me take one more and then we'll start the...
My name's Joshua, and I've found that as I do the sitting meditations, that the longer they last, the more my mind gets off the breath.
Right.
So...
How long?
20 minutes I'm going, and I know in the beginning I'm pretty good in, out, then it wanders a little. I see where I'm wandering, and I get to come back. But then it seems the longer that I do it, I'm wandering more.
Yes, of course. So you know, there's different ways as this can unfold. That's one way. Another way is that as the longer some people sit, the compulsion to think begins to relax slowly, and they find that actually after a certain period of time they think less and less, and they need a certain length of time to make that transition to a more quiet mind, because things have settled down enough. And it can go. What's interesting is that it can go in so many different directions. And it's really useful in this meditation practice of mindfulness not to have a standard by which you're measuring yourself by. It's supposed to be one way or the other. Everyone has their own way. So for you, something happens in you where you, when you first sit down, you can stay focused, and then after a while you can't be focused and mind picks up. So that's an interesting phenomenon for you. That's something about your mind, how your mind works. So the process of mindfulness would be to get... Well, if you're allowed, maybe you have to check with me, get curious. to find out what's going on that's like this for me. And a few things can go on. For example, it could be that it's just simply a muscle of mindfulness, of concentration, which is weak for you. And so you can use it initially, and you have to build up strength. And so you have to build it up by using it. The other is that it's you might be interested when you first sit down, because you know, you sit down with some interest in what you're doing. But you find that actually with time, you can't sustain the interest because other things grab your attention. And so you have a strong tendency to be pulled into planning or pulled into remembering or fantasy or something. And then you say, what's that pull like? What's going on for me? This is, my mind works this way. And not to analyze it, but to really be present in a kind of curious way. What's this going on here? It's not wrong, but it's something to really see. And now, part of the value of this really seeing is that when you really see, you're not caught. And it's the process, the very process of being curious and looking at what makes it hard to be present helps you be present. It's kind of like Aikido. Make some sense? So I wouldn't take this as a bad thing, that's your pattern. I would just take it, this is your pattern. And you got it. But, and if you want the meditation to work, you have to work with that pattern. You have to do your 20 minutes, and over time you'll see it changes. It could also be, well, I'm not saying it's for you, but for some people, that there's a subtle giving up, or a certain complacency, or a subtle complacency, or saying this is difficult, I don't want to, or there can be a little rebelliousness, you know, or there could be boredom sets in, or there's many things that begin setting in that can derail us from what our intention is. And that's all very good to discover. Because what you discover, how your mind operates in meditation, is how your mind's going to operate outside of meditation as well. Meditation is just it's useful to think of meditation as a more high quality way of noticing how your mind operates generally. And as you learn it more about how your mind operates in meditation, you'll actually get more understanding of how it operates in daily life, and because of that, start living a wiser life, a calmer life. So hopefully that makes some sense. Okay, so he wants to, if you can turn it off there, and let me keep it there with you, Martha. Okay, so let's start now with a meditation. And if you could take a comfortable, alert posture. And gently close your eyes. And then without any further efforts to meditate, check in with yourself and notice how you're feeling now. How are you? What's your mood, your emotional state? How are you energetically? And if you use, let your body help you to understand how you're feeling. You tune in to what experience your body's having as you sit here. Does that give you any different sense or understanding of how you are, how you're feeling? And for a minute here, just a minute, experiment with being completely okay with how you're feeling, how you are. Just relax with it, in case you're not. Just let yourself be as you are. Staying close to your body so you feel how it is in your body to feel this way, to be this way. Sometimes in the beginning of a meditation, it's good to just directly check in, partly because the mood or emotional state that you have, if it's not acknowledged, might cast an influence on your efforts to meditate. But if you acknowledge that it's there, it might not have as much influence on you. So to begin a period of meditation, it's often good to take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Breathing in deeply, feeling your rib cage expand and stretch. Breathing in deeply and then breathing out fully. Relaxing as you breathe out, settling in. Breathing in deeply and perhaps relax your belly as you breathe in so your belly also expands out, like almost like it fills with air. As you exhale, relax your shoulders. As you exhale, relax the diaphragm. And then letting your breathing return to normal. And take again, it's a good, at the beginning of meditation, it's good to scan through your body to see if there's any holding that you can let go of. Maybe starting with the forehead, the eyes, soften. Relax your foreheads. Relaxing your jaws. As you exhale, softening the shoulders and the shoulder blades. might be possible to soften in the chest and to soften the belly. Relax the thighs. And then take a few moments to feel your body globally. Feel your body kind of widely and fully sitting here. Contact with the chair, your cushion, the floor. The three-dimensional quality of a human body sitting in space. And then become aware of how your body experiences breathing. Noticing where the breathing is most, experience of breathing is felt most strongly or most compellingly, most comfortably. And then begin to settle your mind, your attention, into the experience of breathing. Every time you breathe out, letting go of what you're thinking about, so you can better feel and sense the body breathing. If it helps you stay on track with the breaths, you can say very quietly in your mind, in, out, or rising as the chest or the belly rises, falling as you exhale. Very quiet, soft whisper in the mind to keep you on track, feeling the breathing. The mind wanders off in thought. No need to be worried or concerned with that. Just as soon as you notice that's happening, see if you can let go of your interest in those thoughts. See if you can let go of your involvement. Let those thoughts float away as you return to your breathing. be alert enough to notice when the mind wanders off in thought, or in judgments, or in reaction to what's happening. And relax. Let go. And give yourself over again to the breathing. Feeling the rhythm of breathing in and out. Entering into the experience of breathing so well that you can feel the difference between the difference in the experience of breathing in from the experience of breathing out. And then as we continue this sitting now, let go of focusing on your breathing for a little while. And instead, bring your attention to noticing how you're feeling. What's your emotional state or your mood, your mental state? It might be very subtle. There's always something of a mood or emotional state, mental state. You might be happy or sad, content or discontented, at ease or uneasy. Calm and relaxed, impatient, or agitated. Dull or hyped up. Angry or irritated. Or loving or kind, gentle. You might be apprehensive, or you might feel confident. If you're able to identify how you're feeling in some simple way, see if you can experiment with bringing a relaxed awareness of how you are, without judgment about it or concerns about it, just to feel it as it is, as if it's okay to feel this way. As if you've never noticed what it's like before. every emotional state or even mental state, a mood, in some way or other shows itself through the body, in sensations, energy, what's activated in your body. In whatever way you're feeling now, emotion you have, how is it experienced physically in the body? Allow yourself to feel it fully in your body, as if it's completely okay for it to reside in your body. And let the body bring your careful attention to that part of the body where it seems most manifest. As you're being present for how you're feeling, does how you're feeling change at all? If it does change, be content to just notice the change. No need to judge or worry about what direction it goes. Just notice. If you're having judgments or commentary or reactions to how you're feeling, can you let those be in the background so you can better just feel how you are in its simplicity as it actually is here and now? For meditation, there's no right or wrong way to feel. Whatever way you're feeling is what you can be mindful of. And then return again to your breathing. Let your attention go fully as you can into just the experience of breathing. If there are strong sensations in your body that make it difficult to be with breathing, then maybe bring your attention to those sensations, be mindful of them. But if nothing else is compelling, stay with your breathing. And we're going to continue for just a couple of more minutes as you settle in more, one breath at a time. And then to end the meditation in a mindful way, take a few long, slow, deep breaths, feeling your body as you breathe in. And then in a relaxed way, when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So, the topic for today's instructions of mindfulness has to do with mindfulness of emotions. And as I've said before, maybe some of you weren't there, but the idea is to learn how to be mindful, how to bring a beneficial attention awareness to all aspects of our life. There's something very special about being mindful, of being attentive, where when we're carefully attentive or fully attentive or directly attentive, there's a kind of freedom there. There's a kind of clarity there. There's a kind of way it helps us not to be enmeshed or entangled or caught in what's going on. It helps to disentangle the kind of forces of the mind that tend to bring us stress. And it tends to also be very relaxing because of it. And for it to be useful in all aspects of our life, we need to learn how to bring attention to the various aspects of our life. And so here, it's, you know, today it's the emotional aspect. And there are people who, there's all kinds of approaches people have to their emotional life. Some of them are personal styles, some are learned by cultural styles. There's the one style is avoid emotions at all cost. Denial, repression, and which, you know, works for a short while. And then there's the other style, which is celebrates every possible emotion as being important and consequential and everyone else should know. And they really get into it all. That's, you know, the whole other, you know, kind of. And the approach in mindfulness, and then there's the approach of some emotions are okay to have and some are not. Some people, growing up in their family, there are certain emotions which were, in a sense, permitted emotions, but some emotions which were not, or some emotions which were highly validated because they got the attention or they got cooperation. I know people for whom the favorite emotion, or not favorite, but the emotion that kind of worked best as a currency of the family dynamics was anger. And so that's what got reinforced, was, you know, because that's how you got attention or that's how you kind of found your way. And then I've known families where anger was never permitted. That was like the, you know, you couldn't show your anger. And so that part was just not, people didn't. So some people have, you know, have a selection process by which emotions okay to feel, which are not okay to feel. Some people live lives numbed out, tuned out from their emotional life, sometimes because there's been trauma or some difficulty and they don't want to feel anymore. And I meet people who really don't feel much below their neck, because no longer feel your emotions, you can't really stop feeling your emotions unless you stop feeling your body. And so people who have had trauma or great difficult emotions, there's often kind of a numbness that sets in or distance that sets in with themselves, because they can't feel. It's too, you know, partly because maybe too scary or too difficult or too overwhelming to open to those. So there's a whole slew of ways in which people relate to their emotional life. The approach of mindfulness practice would be that whatever emotional movement, whatever mood, feeling, impulse, whatever kind of, we can more or less call an emotion, that occurs while we meditate is okay, is appropriate, is allowed. We try not to have any selection process of what we should feel feeling and what we shouldn't be feeling, what's right to feel and what's not right to feel. And there's the idea is to just be mindful in a simple, clear way. This is what's happening, without either repressing it or pushing it away or celebrating or getting really into it. was not being for it or not being against it, but just making room and space for it to be as it is. For people who like to celebrate, it can feel kind of dull. For people who like to keep to repress it, it can be scary. But the idea is to be something very simple. And in the simplicity, there's a kind of a peace that you'll eventually find, a kind of peace of just allowing our inner life to show itself as it is without the judgments that, or preferences we often live by. There's a kind of simplicity to the practice. And meditation is one of the, maybe one of the clearest places in life where you're allowed to have any emotion whatsoever. And it's safe. Like you can have murderous rage in meditation, but for those 20 minutes, you're committed to not moving. And so it's because you're committed not to cause any harm, you're just going to sit there and, you know, you look like, you know, a saint. But, you know, inside it's tumultuous. You have a chance to process it, to open, to see what's there, to let it move through you. It's very fascinating for me that the word emotion comes from Latin, comes from the word prefix e, which means out, and motion, which means motion, moving out. That all emotions are processes that are in motion, that are moving, unless we freeze them, unless we stop them. So, for example, resentment is frozen anger. There are certain kinds of grief that are frozen grief. Certain kinds of depression are frozen sadness, held tight. And so what we're trying to do in meditation is not to hold anything, not to freeze around anything, but let the moving happen again. Let the process happen. Let it unfold. All emotions want to move out. All emotions want to be to move, to be in process, to resolve themselves. And so we sit in meditation to allow, with a tremendous respect for this inner natural process of resolution, of movement, of settling, of opening up that happens. And so emotions are an important part of our life. And we don't go looking for emotions when we sit and meditate. But when they come to us, we allow them to come into our awareness and we're fully aware of them. It's a beautiful process to do. For some people, it's a great process of discovery where they discover a range of emotions and a range of feelings that they weren't really in touch with. And for other people, they learn how to be more balanced with their emotions as they occur. They have no trouble knowing what their emotions are, but they get swept into them, swept away by them too easily. And so this process helps them to come to balance with them all. And you can see them and be with them, but not be influenced or caught by them, or pushed around by them. Make some sense? So before I keep going on here, it might be nice to hear from some of you what it was like in that meditation. Twice during the meditation, I asked you to check in to see how you were feeling, what your emotion was. And what was it like to do those check-ins? And was there a difference between the two ways of doing it, if you remember? Oh, well, I guess, you know, the emotions in this group didn't have any. Yeah. Nothing whatsoever. So straight back there.
I don't know why it was brought on, but all of a sudden, when you said, I'm not even sure what you said, I started crying. It was something was very emotional, and I don't know what it came from at all.
At the beginning or the second one?
The second one. Yeah. I just have no idea how that happened, but I just let it, you know, it just went. And I went like this. I thought, oh, I'm crying. It was just emotional. It just came like boom, and then it just went.
So I mean, it came suddenly and then it dissipated quickly?
Yeah.
It dissipated quickly?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just it didn't last.
Uh-huh. The instructions I gave to turn towards it, feel it in the body, was that helpful for you or?
Yeah, it was. It was kind of nice because afterwards it was just sort of a relief or just if there was something pent up or something, it just kind of went just out like breath, I guess.
Beautiful. Yes, it's one of the things that can happen in meditation is that we relax our guard, we relax the resistance or the distraction we have from, and there's often unresolved issues or feelings that are pent up, and so they finally have a chance to come to the surface. Now, someone who thinks that meditation is a linear process from going from agitated to deep calm might decide, I'm a meditation disaster. I'm not meditating at all. This is going the wrong direction. But actually, it's going the right direction as we begin to free the process and let this stuff flow through us in a nice way. You might actually get more agitated, but actually it's, you're going deeper. Make sense? Was it hard for some of you and you had no emotions? There's another mic here. So go ahead, move this mic. I can't hear.
For me, I found that when you asked me to check in with my emotions, it was very uncomfortable because I was irritable, judgmental, angry. I felt mean. It was just awful. And just staying with it and feeling where it was in the body. And then later on when you said, check in with it again, I couldn't find any of them. It was very strange. And I actually found myself with a little smile on my face.
And so that was wonderful. So do you have any guess of what was involved in that process of having them to not having them?
Haven't a clue.
Haven't a clue? Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a nice smile. Smile like that. So, up here.
So I think the moment you said check in with your emotions the first time, I realized that I felt really angry immediately. And I also noticed immediately that like my back felt really uncomfortable and just I wanted to break out of the pose. And I kept with it, but I felt so aggravated that I almost wanted to scream.
Did I make you angry?
Yeah, it's all your fault.
or did you simply you've been carrying the anger with you, and you hadn't really paid attention because you were directed to look at yourself this way? Then you finally noticed it.
Well, I guess that must be it. I'm usually pretty in touch with my emotions, and I'll admit if I'm angry at someone and to myself. That's why it kind of surprised me that I felt so aggravated and angry at that moment. But then as soon as I got out of it, I feel fine. So it's strange.
Well, it's not uncommon for some people to stay so busy or involved or distracted. They don't really know how they feel. And so this little exercise, notice how you feel. They're surprised at what they discover. That happens. And then the other thing that happens sometimes is that, as I said earlier, there's this backlog of something deeper and deeper that finally gets a chance to get released. To the last one, and then I'll do some more.
Two things happened for me. One was that I found myself actually celebrating that like she mentioned, I'm really in touch with my emotions, and so when I realized I have some fear about some stuff, about some financial stuff, I went, oh, okay, so I'm scared, that's okay. I kind of labeled it. And the other thing was, the second time you said the emotions, I had a hard time getting there because I was lost between what was compelling in my body and my breath.
Yeah.
My leg was screaming, and so I turned my attention to that. And I did that for a few minutes, and it wouldn't dissipate. So I tried to go back to my breath, but my breath was gone. So I tried to create some breath. And then I was like, okay, that's not working. So I went back to my leg, and I was just running back and forth in between those, trying to create breath. And I don't know.
So you said I was running back and forth, running back and forth. So what was driving the running?
My leg hurt, like it was numb up to my knee.
But the pain is not driving it.
Okay.
What was the emotion that was driving your desperately trying to get us?
I don't know.
So I think you missed something.
I think so too.
For someone who's in touch with their emotions.
So when my breath goes away, do I just let it go away and find something in the body?
Yes, yes. Yeah, with the breath, if the breath goes away in meditation, then you go find the strongest sensation in your body and meditate with that until it comes back. So the this brings me to what I was going to say next. Is it okay?
So how does the breath go away? What do you mean by that?
So there's there are times when the breath seems to come to a stop, and seems to come to a stop. And there's a number of reasons why that might happen. Sometimes it happens because people hold their breath. So like in a yoga class, the most common thing yoga teachers seem to say is, remember to breathe. Like, of course people are breathing, but they're not really, they're holding, you know, for a little bit. And so sometimes when there's strong emotions or feelings, some people hold. And the breath will come back, or the breath, they breathe really shallow. So it's not really like a feel like breathing because it's so shallow. So that's one thing that can happen. And it's probably something like that was going on for her. I don't know, because she was having all this pain. When the mind gets really calm in meditation, sometimes the breath gets quieter and calmer and calmer because we don't need so much oxygen anymore. If you're running, you need a lot of oxygen. If you're really quiet and settled, you don't need a lot of oxygen. And so the breath gets calmer and calmer. And most of the oxygen, most of that we breathe in and use for, you know, I guess this energy transfers that go on in our system, is used for energizing the brain. And the brain, when the brain gets calmer and calmer and calmer, it actually needs less energy, less oxygen. And so in deep meditation, when there's a lot of stillness, people have the experience that as much as they try, they cannot perceive any breathing going whatsoever. So when it happens for the first time to people, when it happened to me the first time, I got scared. Because you're supposed to die if you stop breathing, right? That's the conventional understanding. So I remember I was so peaceful and so calm and so happy and got so still, and then I'm not breathing. I took a deep breath. And so it took a while to kind of relax and learn it was okay to go that way. No meditator has suffered, as far as I mean, anybody knows, symptoms of oxygen starvation. But you can go long periods of time where just no perceptible breath going on. So, so emotions are an important part of our life. And emotions are of different kinds. There are many different ways of classifying or categorizing emotions. Buddhism tends to kind of categorize into one way is two kinds. What's called afflictive emotions and what's called beneficial emotions or beautiful emotions. The afflictive ones are the ones that cause us suffering. So if you get really angry, sometimes it's pleasant to be angry. If you get really afraid, like people go to horror movies because they enjoy it, I guess, something about it. But there's also something uncomfortable about those kinds of emotions. And the discomfort that comes with them, that's why it gives it that name of afflictive emotions. It's not that we're judging them as being negative or we shouldn't have them. In meditation, the idea is to open and relaxed way to any emotion, whether it's afflictive or beautiful, just to be present for it. But it's still interesting to know this difference because it speaks to how we relate to what our experience is. So, there's a story, it goes back to the time of the Buddha, where he was talking to a group of students, and he said to them, if a person with bow and arrow comes along and strikes a second person with the arrow, hits them with an arrow, would that hurt? And so the students in the group say, oh yes, it would be hurt to be struck by an arrow. And then the Buddha said, well, if the bowman then went and struck, strung and released a second arrow and struck the man with a second arrow, would that hurt even more? Oh yeah, that would hurt even more to be struck by two arrows. And then the Buddha said, yes, in the same way, the similar way, the first arrow is what life does to you. The second arrow is what you do yourself. So if I'm walking down the sidewalk here and I trip, that's the first arrow. You trip, I hurt myself maybe. The second arrow would be, Gil, you're a klutz. You're a disgrace to walkers. And that's the second arrow. That I do to myself. It's optional whether I do a second arrow like that. I don't have to say I'm a klutz or I'm a disgrace. I could just say, oh, I tripped. That's all. Just keep it really simple. And that the second arrow, then, you know, and then, you know, the Buddha had, it was pretty simple back in the Buddha's time, because in these days I would go, wait a minute, I'm a meditation teacher, mindfulness teacher, I should know better than to feel like I'm a disgrace. Boy, I'm a failure. You know, all these years of practice, I'm just a failure, it's hopeless. That's a third arrow. And then I get angry with myself for feeling hopeless. That's the fourth arrow. And then I get depressed that I'm angry. And that's the fifth arrow. And the sad thing, some of us live our life in a perpetual, you know, adding the arrows, like we live in the 110th generation of arrows, because we're always reacting to what's going on. And it can go on and on. Sometimes it can go on for a lifetime. The reaction to that. Part of the function of mindfulness meditation is to certainly to allow ourselves to feel what we're feeling, but to interrupt the generations of arrows of reactivity. And so at some point, maybe it's 110th generation, maybe it's a second generation, you just let it be there, the situation. At some point in meditation practice, you have to just simply allow things to be. I don't like it, or I love it, allow it to be. Some of the arrows are coated in honey, and so they seem really, they smell good, and they taste good, and you know, they really, they painted really nice and all that. So here's one. So I'm walking down the sidewalk and I don't trip. And all these people are standing watching me walk. And I say, yeah, Gil, there, you just showed them you're a really good walker. That's the second arrow that's coated in honey. Because that's just a setup. The next day when I'm walking down, now I have something to prove, you know, I'm the good walker. And then I trip. Or then I have to kind of reinforce being the good walker. So every time I walk now down in front of you, I'm always concerned about the walking right. You know, and it gets kind of stressful after a while to always be the right walker, right? And so sometimes even there's reactions, there's generations of reactivity which seem good, but it just, you know, it's just set up for more arrows. So when you sit to meditate, some of you probably had second arrows. Maybe your knee hurt. And I've had my knee hurt in meditation, leg hurt in meditation. And an aversion, hating it, is there's nothing required. You're not required to hate pain. Pain is optional. Hate is optional, and so the hate is a second arrow. Another second arrow is self-pity, poor me. An arrow can be a certain kind of fear. And so the idea is to learn how to separate out the experience you're having from the reaction you have about the experience. Does that make sense? And part of the wisdom that comes with mindfulness practice is when you can be settled enough and calm enough and use your attention to just be present for things and begin distinguishing between the reaction and the experience. So with leg pain, there was probably a reaction that was built on some kind of emotion. There might have been fear or anger or aversion to it. And so it's useful to see that. It's possible, oddly enough, I know this to happen in meditation. It's possible to have intense physical pain and joy at the same time. Because the kind of afflictive emotions that can arise don't have to be there. Beautiful emotions can be there at the same time. So that seems counterintuitive to how most people live their lives, where pain seems to be automatic. They require the brain, the mind to be, you know, upset in some way. So an important part of mindfulness meditation is to learn to be mindful of emotions. And the idea is to keep it pretty simple. It's very easy with emotions to start getting complicated and to analyze or try to figure out or try to adjust or to fix or to manipulate or prefer or something. The idea in meditation always, the default, almost like the mantra is, keep it simple. Stay simple. Let's be simple with this. So let's be simple with the emotion. So we stay with the breathing in this meditation practice. That's the default. That's the home base, staying with the breathing. Until something else becomes compelling. If strong sensations in the body, physical sensations are compelling, then we do mindfulness of the body, like we talked about last week. If strong emotions arise, then we do mindfulness of emotions. And what that means is when there's a compelling emotion, and what it means to be compelling means that it's now hard to stay with your breathing. If you have emotions and they're in the background, you can just leave them there. You can acknowledge them, but just leave them there if you can stay with the breath and the breathing in the foreground. But when you have trouble being with the breathing, then let go of the breath. And then bring your attention to feel the emotional state you're having, the feelings you're having. I like to say four kind of steps. Some people like steps. You don't have to do this at all, but some people organized this way can kind of help them find their way with emotions. The first thing to do is simply acknowledge you're having that emotion. And for sometimes that's the big step. I've had emotions that I didn't want to acknowledge when I was younger. I was not an angry person. That was my self identity. And one of the consequences of being a not angry person is that I couldn't admit to myself that when I was angry. I would just kind of have these blinders on. I wouldn't notice that. And there were a few times when people said to me, "Gil, are you angry?" "No." "No way." And because I had this identity that, you know, I kind of, anyway, so I no longer, I don't think that's still an issue. So the first thing is to acknowledge that you're having it there, that whatever it is. And that simple acknowledgement can make a huge impact on things. Just acknowledge, this is how it is now. The second step is to allow it to be there, to give it permission to be there. And for some people, this is a hugely difficult thing because it's all these preferences, all these judgments about I shouldn't be this way, this shouldn't be there, this should be different, or, you know, this is uncomfortable, or this is going well, this is great, I should have more of this. And the idea is to allow it to be there in its simplicity, just as it is, without preference for it going away or getting better or more. Just to allow it to be there. And for some people, that's a whole training in itself to learn to let go of second arrows, and third arrows, and fourth arrows, so the emotion can just be there. It can be very powerful with fear. It's not uncommon for strong fear. The issue is not the fear, but rather it's the fear of the fear. And so to learn how to step, to just let the fear be there, the initial fear to be there just by itself, without adding layers of it on top of it, can be very meaningful for people. So the idea is just to allow it to be there. And it takes a certain degree of trust or confidence that it's okay to do that. Sometimes we have very powerful ideas, messages, that it's not okay to let certain emotions be there. Or we have our own experience, that sometimes strong emotions, if we let them be there, they build up quite an intensity that's not, you know, hasn't been useful in the past. But the idea is to discover how to allow it to be there. So I like to say it partly means just be simple with it. Just try to be simplicity of being. Just let it be. Then the next step is the thing we in our tradition we call mental noting or labeling, and this is where you get to use your thinking in a very, very simple way to help you stay present, rather than letting your thinking do whatever it wants and take you out of the present moment. And so, when you have an emotion, it can be helpful to very soft whisper in the mind, label it for what it is. So if you're afraid, say fear, fear. If there's grief, grief. If there's joy, joy, note joy, joy. If there's contentment or calm, note that. Say that what it is. There's something very, there's a number of functions to do this. One is that by naming it, it's a little bit easier to, it's like a little nudge. You say, stay there to feel it, be there with it. Rather than the mind kind of too easily slipping away into thought or distraction or whatever. So it's a little anchor. Some people call it an anchor. It's like putting an anchor into the emotion so you stay present. Don't float away. The other thing is that there's something in the psyche very powerful about naming something. And that with emotions it can be very effective. It's kind of like the old fairy tales where if you name the dragon loses its power. Or in some cultures that I've been to, you don't tell people your birth name that you're given because there's power associated with that name. And if people know your birth name, they have some power over you. So you have a nickname that people use to call you by. There's something very significant about naming. And the power in naming is that it takes away the power of our identification. But when you name, it's kind of like you step back and from a more kind of independent place, you're acknowledging what's happening as opposed to being enmeshed in it or caught in it or reactive to it. So the idea is to, in a calm voice, inner voice, very softly say, oh, anger, irritation, calm, delight, fear, whatever it might be. So first to acknowledge it's there, then to do the process of seeing can you allow it to be there, just give it permission to be there, and then to name it. The fourth step is to get into it and feel it more fully. Get to know it, investigate it. So one of the best ways of doing that is every emotion, if you're sometimes it's subtle, but every emotion is experienced through your body. If you didn't have a bodily sensation that goes along with that emotion, you wouldn't actually know what emotion you were having. So you probably know a lot of this stuff, right? So like, you might have fear and your stomach is knotted up. You might be angry and all this heat is happening, or your jaws are kind of locked up. Or you might feel a lot of love or generosity and you feel this warmth and openness in your heart area. So there's, and so the idea is to investigate, is to go into your body and feel how it's actually experienced in the body, as opposed to analyzing it, why, when she said that and he did that, this is why I'm feeling now. We, in meditation, that might be useful, but in meditation we don't do that kind of analysis. We want to stay with the present moment experience and let the present moment experience unfold the way it wants to unfold without needing to analyze it or reconstruct it. And so one way to do that is to feel it in your body. As we feel it in the body more, the body is not a story. And so as you're not feeling the story, you're more in the present moment. The body's always in the present moment. So I don't know, I don't think I did it here. I did it recently. But I think it's a good story. I'll tell you the story of maybe interrupt me if I'm repeating myself here. I was teaching a retreat many years ago, and there was a woman who I'd known for some years who was a very challenged woman. She had a lot of suffering in her life, very troubled easily, and a lot of angst and difficulties in many ways. And she was always upset and depressed and angry. And and then she came to a retreat. And during the retreat, there was a special group meditation session that was just pristine. It was like magic. Like everyone seemed to get so peaceful and settled and calm, including the teachers, like me. It was just like so peaceful and it was like beautiful. And it happened to be that right after that meditation session, I was going to meet with her for the interview, the kind of check in with her about our practice that we do. Immediately afterwards, so I went to my little room, sat in my chair, and I felt so peaceful and content. I didn't even want to speak. And she came in and took the chair opposite me, and it was clear that she, like everyone else, had been somehow moved by this very still, peaceful meditation. And for the first time I had known her, she was peaceful and quiet, and seemed like she also couldn't speak. There was a smile, she was peaceful. And the first time I'd known her, she's always kind of like wanting more and wanting more, trying to fix things and do things, always just kind of... But she was just sitting there peacefully and happy. And it wasn't much for us to say to each other. But I think we acknowledged how it was nice, we smiled and recognized how nice it was. And then she said to me, "But Gil, it wasn't this way yesterday. And yesterday," and she started telling me yesterday, the story of yesterday. And as she told me the story of yesterday, she morphed in front of me into a troubled person. Why did she have to tell me the story? why did she sacrifice this piece in order to tell me the story and then relive it and we become the story? So stories, the story-making mind is very, very powerful and casts a big impact on what we feel and what goes on. So part of the task with mindfulness of emotions is to not tell ourselves stories about it. And that's part of why this allowing is very important. Just allow it to be there. Don't tell stories about it. And one of the ways to help us not tell stories is to go into the body and feel how it is in the body. Feel the anger in the stomach. Feel the fear in the shoulders. Feel, you know, wherever it might be. Just feel it. And then feel it as if it's okay for it to be there. Feel it as if the body is the location, the place where the motion part of emotion can occur. If you relax into it and just feel it. So acknowledge, allow, name, and then feel it in your body. These are four steps that are very useful with mindfulness of emotions. Sometimes when we do that, the emotions dissipate, things settle and quiet down, in which case you can go back to your breathing. Sometimes you do this and the emotions get more intense. You just felt lightly irritated, so you went and felt the irritation, and as you felt it, you felt, oh yeah, since I feel it, you know, as this agitated energy in my chest, I think I'll feel it in my chest there. I'll note it, I'll allow it, and this is a good process. Gil said it's good. And I'll just feel and then I'll note it as irritation, that's good. I'll feel it in my body, that's good, it's in my chest. And then it grows. And pretty soon it's rage. That's the way it happens sometimes. And I like to think of it, if it happens in that way, maybe that's because something needs to move through you. Maybe there was just a tip of the iceberg that you had. So again, it's very important in this practice here, even though being, you know, it's a stress-reducing practice, it's definitely a practice that brings peace into people's lives. It's very important not to have some linear idea that, you know, it just always gets better and better. That there's a deep, very deep, important work or very deep, important kind of unfolding or processes that need to resolve themselves in order for us to learn to come to peace. And so sometimes it gets stronger before it gets weaker. And some of the stronger emotions that can happen are not necessarily difficult ones. Some of them are beautiful. There can also be a really intense joy, really intense experience of peace and calm. And the idea there is to allow them to happen. And most people think, well, yeah, that's great. But some people are frightened of those. Some people are reluctant to have those really intense experiences of joy. Certain religious backgrounds seem to condition people to believe that it's not okay to experience a lot of physical joy that can happen in meditation. And so they feel it. Oh, something's wrong. I can't do this. And that's okay, too. So we feel that when that comes up. Always remember to keep this simple. And then come back to your breathing. Always, if you don't know what to do, just go back to your breathing. If you're wondering, well, what's supposed to be, what did Gil say? I'm having an emotion, but I don't remember. Go back to your breath. Just go back to your breath. And then from there, maybe then you can find your way into what's going on. So any questions about that, or clarification you like, or any ways that you're confused? Yes, please.
So there's on the cushion and then off the cushion. So if we want to bring this into daily life, not just on the cushion, right? Any words?
Yeah, so the more we learn how to do this on the cushion in meditation, the more we learn the skill of how to do this in daily life in a way that's useful. So you're more likely to recognize what your emotions are and notice it sooner. You're more likely not to be caught by it, more likely able to be more independent of it, to be more equanimous when it happens. You get angry, and you can feel the anger, you know you're angry, but you're less likely to act from the anger because you have the ability to be mindful of it. If you develop this coming back into your body and feeling in your body, you might find your body is stabilizing. That's a way of being present for an emotion in a difficult situation where the emotion doesn't get the upper hand. But you can be there and just kind of be in the background because you feel it in the body. So there's many, you know, there's many situations to explore this. And so in some situations you can do it in ways that are very similar to meditation. It's okay, whatever is going on, you can let it bubble up and be there and fine. Other situations where you have to be have some discernment about it because, you're furious at your boss. Maybe it's not the right time and place to sit there and open up to your anger and feel it and name it. maybe that could create a big disaster for you if who knows? I don't know what the relationship is to your boss, but so they may have to be maybe a little bit wise about what, maybe you need to go to the bathroom and do it there or, wait till you see your therapist or something. A fun thing I've done with emotions is many years ago. I haven't done it for a long time, but is to track the kaleidoscope of all the subtle emotions that come up when I'm driving on the freeway. So there's the overall general mood. I'm having good. I'm happy and happy-go-lucky. I'm driving on the freeway. Everything's good. But then this car cuts me off. And I'm a, easygoing guy, but I get a little irritated. And then a second later, this beautiful, beautiful, Tesla, Maserati, hybrid comes along and it's red. And so there's desire. And then this cop car pulls up behind me. And then I know I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm just driving along, but then, there's a little even though I know I've done nothing wrong, the fact that he's in my tail, I feel a little fear. And then this person drives by who's just like so attractive. And then this person's driving slow. And then this person's doing that. And then I realize I'm a little bit late. And, if I pay attention to the real subtle things, I can feel there's kind of a waterfall, a rippling through of all these little movements. And so it's kind of fun. It's kind of to watch. But it's more than fun because some of those involve tension. And like, you know, so like the little cop car, right? I'm a little tense. Or the desire, I'm a little tense, wanting not to lean towards it, you know. It might seem very innocent, each one of those little subtle things. But the accumulation of those over a whole day, of 10,000 ones of those, it builds tension, builds stress over time. So if you're able to track them as they occur, they tend not to build the stress. So I don't know if that, you know, I could say a lot more, but let's leave it for that now. One more? We have time for one more? Yes.
I have kind of a question about the arrows. And I'm going to use your metaphor. Let's say you're beginning your walk down the sidewalk, and you say to yourself, you know, I have a tendency to get distracted and trip. So this time I'm going to pay attention, I'm going to look where I'm going, and I'm not going to trip. You make it about halfway down the block, you get distracted, and you trip. Okay, on the one hand, you don't want to spend the rest of the day or the week or the month shooting yourself full of arrows. On the other hand, it's not okay. I mean, you need to learn to stop doing that.
Right, I agree.
So where do you find the balance between those two states of mind? I mean, you've done something wrong, or you've done something foolish, you've done something you know better than to do. You've kind of let yourself down. But on the other hand, you don't want to shoot yourself full of arrows. So is there some middle ground somewhere?
I don't know if it's middle ground, but there's an alternative.
Okay.
There's a wise alternative. So this whole approach of just learning how to be present and not do second arrows doesn't mean that there's no wisdom operating. And when you're being wise and discerning, you can recognize when you've made a mistake. So, you know, and you can recognize that I need to correct something here in my life. So tomorrow when I walk down this road, I've tripped like 3 days in a row in the same place. I think I need to learn from my mistakes. So tomorrow, let me see what I can do to do better. Let me try to be mindful as I walk down the sidewalk. And 3 more days, you keep tripping. You're like, this is not helping. I can't do it. I better take a mindfulness class. So there are choices we make that can be wise and appropriate where we make corrections for what's going on. I'm not saying just keep going along and trip, you know, every day. Is this kind of what getting to your question, or you want to ask again now?
I guess I have to think about it some more.
I think it's a very good question, so please do.
Okay.
And bring it back next week. So you really want to ask a question? Okay. In the back, if you can pass the mic all the way to the back. And then this will really be the last question. And we'll have to stop. But if you can wait for the mic.
Comment on the constant tripping, but just more so that I think working off of bumps in the road and arrows now, but this notion of actually kind of taking note what are you still tripping on and kind of hanging out with that, I think is also important. I feel like there's sometimes the bump in the road, you kind of have to peel away layers, and like maybe
yes,
like
I
the
agree.
Initial bump, like it might look like, oh, it's just...
So if I understand what you're saying, yes. So for example, it could be that you know, 3 days in a row I've tripped to the same place. I say, you know, I could figure out a, you know, solution. I could get a suit of armor, so next time when I trip, I won't hurt myself. You know, that's one, you know... Or, you know, I noticed this happened 3 times in a row. I think maybe I need to let this happen again. But next time, not to avoid tripping, I need to see what happens just before. I need to see, you know, and I need to understand how I get distracted and what's going on when I get distracted. What are the feelings? What are the emotions? What's really operating in me? Because maybe there's depths of self-understanding needs to happen of how you are before your trip. Is this what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the fact that you have a reaction or you do have a second arrow in some way that, this is part of the mindful life is a life that you stop and try to learn what's going on in a deeper way. And then you can use mindfulness to learn, help with that process because you're trying to be fully present in a deeper and deeper way for what's happening. So it could be, for example, that, you know, The reason why I trip when I'm walking down that sidewalk every day is because I'm just so filled with my, you know, conceit of being like such a good walker. And I always, and it happens to be that I trip at the place where all of you guys are lined up watching me walk. And so what I need to do is not to figure out how to walk better and more mindfully. I need to deal with my conceit. And that's more useful. So I'll end it with a joke. There was an executive of a very large corporation who had to do these, you know, major every year, you know, speech to all the stockholders, I guess, shareholders and board and everything. And he was a great executive, but he had one fault or one problem, that when he stood in front of too many people to give a talk, he would pee in his pants. So the board thought, this is not good. So they sent him to therapy, to think there was some kind of psychological problem. So after some months, he came back and he said, therapy's been good. I'm good now. And they said, he said, oh, good, you no longer pee in your pants? And he said, no, I still pee in my pants, but I don't care now. So I don't know if that's a good ending for the class today, but that's the message I want to get across. But our reaction, our relationship to what's going on, there's depth there, so of the different things to discover. So there is this handout for today that kind of reviews the instructions on mindfulness. It's kind of purple there, Martha has. And you're welcome to ask me questions. Stay behind if you want. And Shin Kwan is standing in the back if you want to ask her questions. Also, next week we'll do mindfulness of thinking. So those of you who just couldn't hold off on your thinking, we'll catch up to you next week. And we'll talk about how to use mindfulness in relationship to thinking. And for many people, that's one of the most difficult things about mindfulness, is what their thinking mind does and how we get easily distracted. So it's an important class. So thank you very much.